Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2019. I'm now here with my old friend, he was known as Reactionary Expat. He's now known as The Franklin because that is the name of his channel and it's linked in the description, so please take a look at it. I'm so tempted. I just by default think I should address you as Expat.
No.
I think from now on I'll call you Franklin. I'll try to remember that. So
sure.
Franklin. You want to talk about culture creation, because I think you and I have often... Welcome to Millennial and welcome to the channel.
Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to... It's always good to talk to you. You and I lamented for a long time that the dissident right, the alt-right, as it was called then, didn't have a lot of culture in it. It was mostly politics and sort of complaining about the world. And I think you and I always wanted it to be more of a cultural thing, and so that's what we're going to speak about in this stream. So,
yeah.
Okay, would you like to first tell people about your channel briefly?
Okay, so I've actually written down some points so I can try to keep this sort of on track. My channel, I used to have another channel, and mostly at that channel I did sort of cultural analysis, if you like, so social analysis, that sort of thing. And I began my current channel doing that sort of thing as well. But this year, for probably three quarters of the year, I've been recording an audiobook. So I've been almost entirely focused upon that for this year. That's about to finish. I've uploaded the last video and scheduled it. That will come out on the 31st. After that, I will return to sort of more normal stuff, but I'll probably start doing some things about sort of solutions to a lot of the problems that I see. So I'm going to end up doing more stuff on homeschooling and gardening and that kind of stuff. But certainly for this year, it's mostly been about this audiobook. And I'd like to sort of talk about the genesis of that, how I... came to write the book, because this actually relates to you. Because back, this must have been when, probably 6 years ago or more now, 7 years ago, you actually gave me a copy of your own book
to read. I can't believe it's that long ago.
Yeah, it must have been 2012, because I wrote my book in 2013, at the beginning, well, sort of early 2013. So it must have been 2012.
Yes, I think it would have been late 2012, because that's when I was, I know for a fact that that's when I was, I wanted to, I desperately wanted to have something done, and so that was what I chose to do. This is like about 2 years before I started the channel. So, yeah, or no, not maybe not, no, only actually a year before I started the channel. So I only really worked on the novel for about a year and a half, from the middle of 2012 and to the middle end, it's our last quarter of 2013. And that was when I stopped, because I started the channel, Millennial Bose, on YouTube. And so it was annoying, because by the time I stopped, it changed a lot in 20... Like, I wrote most of the storyline and... I'd probably really maybe 2/3 of the book in late 2012. It sort of just poured out of me. But then in 2013, I spent quite a long time finessing it and adding in a whole new subplot. And so by the time I started the channel in October, I started working on it in October 2013, the book was about 90% finished. And it's remained at that level at that point ever since. Because the channel just took over my life, as you know very well. So that's my story here. So you take it away.
Yeah, well, I was very much inspired by what you did. I thought it was really good. I know that you added that whole extra subplot, which I didn't get to read. But what I read, I thought was a pretty good finished product. So that was an inspiration for me. Also, I had a friend from university who was writing a book at the time. So all of this sort of inspired me to write my own book in what was it, the beginning of 2013, I think it was. This was around the same time that I also discovered Neo Reaction. And there was just this enormous amount of information going into my head, and I had to get it out some way. So I started writing a book.
Do you want to give some cultural background to this, some context? Because I think people might be quite interested in hearing about where you and I were at that point. I mean, we met on a forum. I don't think we need to name it. It was sort of paleo-conservative forum. And I discovered Davis Arini because somebody on that forum linked to a Davis Arini video. And we were also talking about the Reactosphere and paleoconservatism and neo-reaction. And this was in 2012, 2013. That was sort of really the thing at the time. It was before the alt-right. It was before the alt-light, before the dissident right. There was the Reactosphere, which was a part of a broader thing called the Dark Enlightenment, which, you know, I always hated that. I was cringed at that word. But so is that relevant to what you're saying?
There was this, it's one of those things. Once you discover one thing, you follow the links, and next thing you know, you've gone down an entire rabbit hole. So I just encountered a massive amount of information. And to me, both then and still now, it felt like coming home in an intellectual sense or in a political sense. And I had all this information in my head that I needed to get out in some sense. So I did. So I ended up writing this book. And that was a whole project that took me about 4 months in 2013. And then in early 2014, I wrote another book. It's meant to be a trilogy, so I've written the second book, but that still needs a lot of work. But I sort of put it down for various points in time. I mean, I was quite burnt out with it. It's quite long.
I think we should, again, we're skipping ahead here. I showed you my novel at the end of 2012, and that I think that inspired you to write your own novel. Is that how that took place?
In part, yes, because also I had a friend. I've visited him in 2011. He actually moved to Tasmania to sort of be away from everyone so that he could write his own book. And I visited him there. So I'd already been sort of, my interest had already been piqued by what he told me about what he was doing. And then getting to know you and then your book, it sort of made me think, wow, if these guys can do it, I can do it. And that's very much what I'd like to talk about today as well, later on in our chat, about trying to inspire other people to do this sort of thing. So I already had some ideas about what to do for a book, but then there was this revelation politically and philosophically with Neo Reaction. So then I just started writing. It was very much a case of just get words on the page. I read something by, I think it's J.G. Ballard, who's a science fiction writer. He used to just write 500 words a day regardless of what was happening. I think he said even if he were hungover or something like that, he would get 500 words on the page, whether they were good or bad. So I just started doing that, and then it all just kind of came out. So I did this for a few months, and then I did some editing, and then later on I wrote the second book. But then I put it down for quite some time, and then, of course, I started my own channel and all of this sort of stuff, so I was more focused upon that. But the last year, I began to get increasingly frustrated with just commenting on current affairs and even sort of socio-political analysis and this sort of thing. Maybe other people get something out of it, but I got to the point where I wasn't getting anything out of it either as a content producer or as a consumer of those things. And I began to get this feeling that we need to actually produce something. There needs to be effort.
Just before you get into that, I want to make a humorous point that Arini inspired, or his channel inspired me to create my channel. My channel inspired you to create your channel. And then your channel apparently inspired the distributist to start his channel.
It's interesting. Yeah, it is. So I began to get this feeling that we need to actually do things that are going to be longer lasting. Because one of the things about commenting upon the latest political outrage or whatever is that if you were to go back and watch a video that would have been very current at a particular time, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever, it wouldn't have the same currency today. So people aren't ever really going to go back and look at that. You know, nobody goes and gets a newspaper from 1974 and reads that back to front, right? Because it's sort of irrelevant. You know, they might get the broad themes from a history book or that sort of thing, but they don't go and do that. So this thing, it's very much obsessed with the here and now. And you always, and then you get on a kind of content treadmill as well. So I wanted to move away from all of that. And I came up with the idea of, pardon me, of producing an audiobook from my own book, because that was also something that I thought would be kind of novel as well. That almost like one of those old sort of serialized radio shows, something like that. So I came up with that idea late last year, but it was going to be a daunting project because this book's about 530,000 words long. So I knew it was going to be huge and a real commitment. Although that was good in a way also because it actually forced me to produce content regularly because I've been uploading two chapters every week. So it forced me to produce content. There's also another reason why I wanted to do all of this, because perhaps this can tie into reflecting upon the last decade. What I have noticed, particularly in the past couple of years, but really over this decade, is that mainstream culture, whether we're talking about film, architecture, art, whatever, it's just become absolute poison. We're just surrounded by this absolutely grotesque monstrosity of a thing. And I think we need to start producing our own culture. I mean, we've got old books and old films and all of that sort of stuff. But I think in terms of current things, we need to produce our own culture. So this is also a way of doing that and hopefully of inspiring other people to do likewise. And one more, I don't know if you want to respond to that because there's another long point that I'd like to make as well.
Well, what specifically?
Another point with all of this is that the book itself started to sort of become blended with my own life in the sense that there's this maxim in Neo-Reaction of become worthy. And the book itself is sort of about a hero's journey in some respect. So it was all part of this thing of rather than just responding to outrage porn and all of this kind of stuff on the right, we need to become worthy. We need to become culture creators. We need to sort of have that hero's journey of going through this process ourselves. And it's quite an arduous process and come out the other side. And as part of that process, inspire others to do likewise so that we sort of the whole thing snowballs, the culture itself snowballs, and ultimately that we create our own culture for us, by us, rather than
perpetually be abused by the mainstream culture and perpetually be amazed by it as well, sort of entranced. I think that's the word I'm looking for, entranced by this smorgasbord of just degeneracy and confusion. Yeah.
To either be passive consumers of that or sort of angry reactors, to be reactionary rather than reactive, in a sense.
Yes. The way I put it.
So that's sort of a long way of getting to what this whole thing was kind of about. And so it's not even that this has to be fantastic art, you know, great art or anything like that. It doesn't need to be that. I mean, I'm not in a position to judge that myself anyway. But it's not that this has to be great art, but rather it has to be sort of the first step on a long journey for other people to do that. You know, that for every Beethoven that's produced, there are 100,000 kids plonking away on the piano learning C major scale, and one of them will become Beethoven. And you don't know which one that will be. But if we don't even have those numbers to begin with, then we're not going to produce that for ourselves.
Oh, absolutely not. I think you, as you say, you can't know where greatness is going to emerge from. So you have to try to set as many things in motion as possible.
Yeah. So that's sort of the idea behind this project. Without getting into sort of the nitty gritty of, you know, what the story is about, and maybe we can talk about that later. But that's sort of the macro theme for this, if you like.
I think the concern when you say we need to become content culture creators, content creators, but no, there's a difference there, though, isn't there? As you've just outlined, I mean, there can be content that is that's contentless. It's just outrage porn, and I think that the way to do that, apart from to do just meaningless live streams for, you know, talking about nothing and talking about your own life and, you know, drivel and your shopping list, the other way to arrive at contentless content is to be always reacting to current affairs. Now, there are ways of reacting to current affairs that are not bad. I'm not saying it's always bad, but certainly it's a danger where you're just constantly skating on the top level of cultural happenings and never really coming to understand anything in depth, or coming to understand oneself in depth. I mean, it's a sort of very common thing that people are very busy because they're running from themselves. And I think that one of the dangers when we talk about becoming culture creators is, are we sure that we are worthy of creating culture? In other words, are you yourself a mess? And now, obviously, got to be careful here, because a lot of artists are, you know, messies. Yeah, they're not the most well balanced people, and often it's their own chaos is where their creativity comes from. I was talking about this in a stream a few nights ago at AMA, but nonetheless, traditionally at least, artists were equipped with an understanding of their heritage, their civilization, and so on, which enabled them to add to that pantheon meaningfully. I think that's a massive part of the problem today, is that we're all, even those of us who have had good educations, it's still nowhere near as good as it would have been in the past. I mean, you can even see that in celebrities and in intellectuals and commentators, journalists, politicians. They're not what they would have been in the 50 years ago.
No, absolutely. But I think also perhaps there's maybe somewhat of a counterpoint to that. People who create things, they won't know whether what they're doing is really going to stand the test of time. They'll create those things and then they're out of their hands at that point, and history will judge them accordingly. So the great works of art will be judged by history. They won't be judged by the creators at that particular moment in time, or even necessarily the people listening to or reading or looking at that art that's being produced at that time. It might take later generations and so on. So I think part of the creative process is simply to put it out there, and then it's out of your hands. But it's that act of putting it out there and hopefully inspiring other people, creating enough of a groundswell of people doing these things that the culture will emerge organically, and then history will judge based upon what's available.
Yes. And I think that we don't, I mean, if we're talking about a sort of contest about which artwork from the current era is going to stand the test of time, we don't have much of a bar to jump over to beat the mainstream, because the mainstream culture today is absolutely appalling. I know that's an extremely blanket statement, but I think it's simply true.
Yeah, well, that's another thing about this, that I'm not convinced that direct political action is the solution. I think, though, that it's becoming more and more apparent to people, even with whatever is being put out, whether it's Star Wars or James Bond or any of these things, that it's just complete garbage. And it's that stuff is so highly politicized that we're at a point now where the good, the true, and the beautiful are revolutionary acts in and of themselves. And people are starting to notice just how grotesque the mainstream is. And simply producing something that's good, true, or beautiful will draw people to it. And that's what we need to do. It doesn't even necessarily have to be an overt political act, because sadly, the times in which we live have made that an overt political act in a sense. So it's a matter of, if people start doing that, other people will, because they're noticing how bad the mainstream culture is, they will start to come over to our side. And it's also that a lot of people, they're not particularly sophisticated in how they judge things, but they are very perceptive at a basic level. So if they see that this other thing, this, say, mainstream art is really grotesque, they will start to associate the political ideas that are associated with that with ugliness, and they will start to have a quite an adverse reaction to that. On the other hand, once they start to see that we're producing beautiful things, for instance, they will be more receptive to the broader ideas that we have. So it's that sort of optics thing in a sense too. Just produce nice music, produce nice novels, produce nice films, and people will start to move over this way. But there needs to be that culture. Otherwise, we're just surrendering all of that ground. And as unfortunate as it is, if people only have one option and it's a bad option, they will take that bad option.
Yeah. I have for a long time seen the cultural thing as absolutely essential to, and if you want to change society, I'm nervous about saying this publicly because I think our enemies already know this, what I'm about to say anyway, because they constantly shut down channels that are purely artistic or creative, like all these music channels, and so, especially get shut down, even though they're Zurius is a perfect example, even though they're not hate speechy. But I think our enemies have a nose for they can smell out things that are going to that are going to lead to something else. They can detect it, and so
of course. But that's sort of the modern thing that people are starting to notice, that things that aren't sort of a Hollywood caricature of the far right, normal things that just happen to be beautiful and true and good and so on, those things are being hunted down, and normal people are starting to wake up to that. Wow, what's their opposition to this for? Why are they so obsessed with, this is just a guy making music, right? They're starting to notice that the mainstream now seems to stand for nothing but ugliness. So that in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. And history has often had that art has not necessarily been accepted by the authorities as such. It's often stood as its own thing. So we could use that to our advantage.
Well, the point I was going to make was that I think that basically everything starts with culture. And
yeah,
so if your goal is, and if you have a specific political goal in mind, you should start with culture. But as it happens, I don't really, I mean, I want my people to survive, but other than that, I don't really have a political goal in mind. So I'm not of that mind. It's not like everything I do is in order to eventually be able to present a political manifesto to the world. On the contrary, I think I'm at the stage where I just want to explore ideas. However, I think that for all sorts of reasons, whether it's political reasons or cultural reasons or just curiosity, I think there is a need to, if not necessarily ignore the politics for now, but to concentrate on the cultural stuff first. Because, as I said, everything starts with that. For example, if you want to get good people interested in our ideas going into the political sphere, then they have to be introduced to our ideas somehow. So, and the best way to do that is probably through cultural artifacts, like cultural products, music and so forth. And of course, comedy, things like that, things that are more verbal. So all of this, I think, is necessary. Without culture, everything is too threadbare. There has to be something that is is more substantial than human, I think, for want of a better word.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that if we were to consider Europe's heyday culturally, whether we think it was the hand of God or whether we think it was merely propaganda, it's hard to distinguish that. But nevertheless, the great cathedrals of Europe or something like Bach, hearing classical music in a setting where it would have been played, it's more than just watching a YouTube video, or it's more than just hearing something on the radio. It's something else. And this was partly by design. I mean, whether people were fully conscious of this or not, that's how things were presented to them. And it's hard to be in one of those situations in a cathedral listening to the music of Bach, for instance, and not feel something beyond that. And that's the kind of aspiration that we should have with this sort of thing. We should be getting to a point where it's like that, because normies notice that too. Even when you get these sort of sappy middle-class white leftists, when they go to one of these places or they hear one of these things, I mean, every time I've been to a classical music concert in the past year, it's been 95% white. And it's all that, you know, it's the same kind of people who are very, very politically correct in their thinking, but they seek that out and they're inspired by it and moved by it. That's not coincidental. And the left and the mainstream have become so grotesque that merely presenting something that's beautiful is itself a revolutionary and highly political act and will draw people to it. And that's, we're at the point almost where we can win by default, simply by doing those kinds of things. I mean, not entirely, but you know what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, I think that, as I said earlier, that there's not much of a hurdle to jump to beat this. The mainstream is appalling. But I guess the question then that would obviously occur to people is, well, okay, you're telling us to create culture, but what does that mean? What culture?
Well, it's anything. So, it's anything. I mean, you don't have to compose a symphony. It can be a folk band. You know, there's as much validity in folk music as there is in classical music. They fulfill different roles, but they're both necessary. It's like you need the king, but you need the serf as well, in a sense, or the yeoman. People each occupying a different place in society, and it doesn't mean that that they should be starved of dignity just because they're in a lower place within the society. They have a role to play and they're integral to the society. So it can be just little things like that. It doesn't have to be, you know, I'm going to compose a huge symphony. It can be a much smaller and less ambitious project than that. It can be a short story. It doesn't have to be, you know, a 10-volume series, that sort of thing. Anything, basically. That's what culture is. People used to create their own culture because they didn't have access to mass culture. One figure that I'm sort of fond of throwing around is that about 100 years ago, Australia had a population of 3 million people, and there were 700,000 pianos in Australia. And most of those pianos were brought out from Europe. They, you know, you can imagine what that would have been like at the time.
Yes.
But that's because people, they didn't have Netflix. They didn't have YouTube. They didn't have these things where they could just instantly tap into mass culture. I mean, they did. There were things that were in the mass culture, everything from nursery rhymes to classical literature or whatever. But people created their own culture on the spot in their local communities. And some of these things caught on elsewhere, and some of them were highly localized, but they created their own culture. It wasn't a grand, ambitious project. It was their daily life.
Yes, indeed. And it is, therefore, that it's folk culture, it's local culture. Somebody has said in the live chat, they can just ban our art, meaning they can ban our culture. We need to get into politics. Now, I think that's worth addressing, because this is the whole point. Without that cultural underpinning, without that groundwork laid, we won't get into politics, or if we do, we'll be completely swamped by the mainstream culture. It will prevent us from doing anything meaningful. So in other words, you're trying to run before you can walk, basically. Would you like to take that, Franklin?
Yeah, there are two points I'd like to make about that. One is that that then corrals people into politics that is obsessed purely about current affairs and purely about neoliberal economics and all of that sort of stuff. It's a very sort of narrow, short-sighted, unambitious form of politics then that is completely devoid of culture or anything beyond the here and now, where economics and the next issue is front and center, and that's as far as it ever goes. It keeps people safely corralled within that way of thinking about politics, rather than anything that's a little bit more dangerous, such as having an actual culture and an identity and so on. The second thing is that I think that one of the other big changes about the past 10 years is that the internet has really come of age in a sense that I don't think they're ever going to put the genie back in the bottle. They can ban people's
channels. I don't.
They can ban art. It's not. They're not going to be successful.
Yeah, I agree. One thing I would want to say, and this is something I've wanted to, I think I've probably made this point before on air, but I want to say it again because it's certainly relevant to this discussion. When I think about culture that I would like to see and cultural products, that does not mean a song in which the vocalist is singing about mass immigration and how bad it is, and how, you know, like a band name that has some absurd, like Iron Fist or something, like that, you know, something ridiculous. But it's just okay. And this is a problem because I think a lot of right wingers, frankly, and this is going to sound really awful and elitist, but I think a lot of right wingers just don't know how to handle. How to approach culture creation. I think that they assume it has to be implicitly and explicitly political. If I do a poem, it has to be something about white identity. If I do a film, it has to be something about against feminism, or even like ranting about feminism. That's not how the left ever, even if you were trying to change culture, change society through the culture, if you're trying to make political change through the culture, you wouldn't, like the left did 60 years ago, even then you wouldn't go about it like that. You wouldn't go about it that clumsily, you know, crudely. You would be more subtle about it. So, and I'm not saying that, I at the same time, I'm aware that I think it's kind of philistine to make political art. I don't like the very concept of political art, because it's always going to be just propaganda dressed up as in disguise, and I don't like that. I think it's cheap. It's degrading for everyone. But the point is that even if you did want to make political art change society, you wouldn't do it that clumsily, right? And this is something that the right, I think, really need to learn this lesson desperately, because until they do, you're just going to have these bad things being produced, which are just obvious, right wing propaganda. It's not something that appeals to normal people. That's the thing. You gotta, and people will say, "Well, we don't want to appeal to normal people." You need to. You don't have a choice. You have to try to reach the mainstream, try to win them over. And so, I really think we need to get far more intelligent and sophisticated about this stuff.
There is a role for some of that, in that a lot of traditional folk songs, for instance, are about specific events and trying to remember specific things that happened and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, art has to be a lot more than that. And my book, there is a lot of sort of red pill wisdom, if you like, dropped in there. But ultimately, it has a story that's separate from that, and it's about separate issues.
Exactly. I mean, when people read, I'm going to use an example that I haven't actually read, Lord of the Rings. People don't read Lord of the Rings because they want to read right-wing propaganda or nationalist propaganda. They read Lord of the Rings because it's even though I haven't read it, I'm just going by what everyone said. It's a fantastically well-written story with rounded characters, exciting ideas, very well-drawn settings and worlds, etc. If they wanted right-wing nationalist propaganda, they could read a book that was right-wing nationalist propaganda. So, I mean, for God's sake, you know, I think we really have to understand what we're doing here. Well, what would you say about that, Franklin?
Yeah, certainly. I think if these things are produced well, actually, it's very difficult to tease the two apart, the sort of political ideas or philosophical ideas or what have you, and the actual story itself, because the good, the true, and the beautiful are linked. And if art is produced well, those things will all be present, but they will sort of be greater than the sum of the parts. And people will implicitly understand the sort of philosophical message, if you like, but they'll arrive at that in a way that, where they're not even conscious of it in many regards. They just sort of take these things on naturally. They just start to understand them without consciously thinking, oh, okay, that's what that guy's saying there. They'll just understand the good, the true, and the beautiful without anyone having to sort of dissect this section of the book or what have you.
Yes, okay. Someone is saying art and politics cannot be separated. Okay, it's implicit. Yeah, the creator's political notions, beliefs, might be implicit in the work. I think that's probably likely.
Yes.
But it shouldn't be clumsy. Right? The
work shouldn't be hit around the head with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you go on this, because I think I've said my piece on this, so I'd like to hear it in your words.
Yeah, well, that's why I actually really dislike Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged. Even though there was a time when I really liked the sort of political message, I really disliked the writing because I found it clumsy. And another example of this that I really disliked is in War and Peace. At the end of War and Peace, Tolstoy has this whole sort of philosophical section that I think is jarring. I think the book itself, the storyline, should sort of stand for itself, and it doesn't need this thing that's tacked on. So I think if it's done well, I mean, the cathedrals of Europe were inherently political statements. I mean, they towered over the landscape. Right? Everyone was aware of, they literally reached up to God. They were clear manifestations of power and all of this sort of stuff. But it wasn't just that. They weren't, because we have these big gargantuan things that tower over the landscape now. And yeah, I guess in a sense they are sort of temples to ugliness and a form of power in their own right. But it wasn't just that. That when people saw these cathedrals, there was something else going on as well. And all of that, it was very subtle, of course. These developed over a long period of time, and the artwork, all of the design features and so on were very clever. But I think if you had said to anyone, okay, tease out those specific things, tease out what it is exactly about that that has this particular effect, it would be difficult to articulate those things in most cases, and yet they had those effects. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of artwork was itself, like the Baroque period was almost a reaction to something else with a specific goal in mind, but it was still beautiful in and of itself. And that's why people were attracted to it, because it wasn't merely slapping them about the face with a sort of a philosophical objective. It was in and of itself a wondrous thing.
Yes. Yes, there are a lot of comments coming in. I think some people think I'm naive about my view on this. Look, all I can say is when I see a right-wing musician and they've got some name that is just, I don't know, I can see what it's going to be. I know exactly what it's going to be just from the name of the band. I think, who is this supposed to reach? Who's this? What's it supposed to be for? And I don't really understand what they're trying to do, other than it just seems very insular.
I would say if I were to become a Catholic, for instance, it would in large part be because of classical music. It would in large part be because of classical architecture, or I don't want to use the word classical there because that refers to a specific kind of architecture, but old architecture, shall we say. It would be because of those things in large part, because I think part of what those guys were getting at also was that the hand of God was in their work. It's that sort of thing, that when you listen to Bach, when you listen to any of the music, say prior to the Second World War, there was that feeling in there, and it was hard to distinguish, but there was that in there. Likewise with architecture and all of the rest of it, that it's hard to look at a Gothic cathedral and not think that something is going on there. And that's the point, I think, that both you and I are trying to make here.
Yes. Yes,
and that's going to stand the test of time. People are still looking at these Gothic, you know, when Notre Dame burnt down, when was that, last year or this year?
April this year.
I mean, everyone was freaking out about it, right? Now, that's something, I know it had been sort of restored at various points, but that's something, that's 1,000 years old. And people from all over the world, not just from the West, but from all over the world, were going there almost as a pilgrimage in a sense. And they were inspired and awestruck by that. Now that's 1,000 years old. I think there's something to be learned from that. The ham-fisted attempts that people might have now at creating overt political language, are people still going to be making pilgrimages to witness those things in 1,000 years' time?
Well, exactly.
Not necessarily. Maybe, yeah, but
because it doesn't hit them at that level. It might be a short-term political import to them, but it's not going to be something that touches their soul. I know some people will say that sounds really gay of me, but I think that's what it's all about. I mean, this is what art is for.
Yeah, that's right. It's transcendent, and it's outside of the moment. It's not something that people are going to. It's not like whatever this year's fashion is in clothing, and people aren't going to look back at photos of it in 20 years' time and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe I used to wear that." People are still going to be looking at Gothic cathedrals in another 1,000 years and saying, "Wow, that's amazing, that building." I mean,
hopefully,
yeah, that's right. And you can see that in other cultures too. I mean, I've been to a lot of places in the world, and you can see through architecture and so on that people had sort of arrived at, there's something curiously universal about these things in a sense, but nevertheless that they had their own forms. And I can admit that I've been to various temples and other buildings in other parts of the world and thought, wow, that's amazing, that thing. How did they do that? And that's really beautiful. And I think there's something to be said for that, that stands in and of itself, hundreds, thousands, whatever, of years later, rather than this thing that we're doing right now for a very specific political purpose to beat people about the head with.
Yes, exactly. So would you like to now talk about your novel? Or is there any more that you'd like to say on this matter first?
No, I mean, I just want to inspire other people to do this. And as I said earlier, people don't have to think of it as a daunting task, like, oh, well, I could never compose a symphony. No, but there's probably something that you could do. And that's not to say also that we should just abandon what's come before us in terms of culture. But I think that it's good to create new things as well. But I would just like to inspire people to do that. And in terms of the novel itself,
before you get into the novel itself, you've said you want to inspire people to do that, and they shouldn't be intimidated. Do you have any advice, any tips for how to put together a story and a novel? I mean, a lot of people will never, who might actually be good at it, will never have thought of doing that before because they'll think it's a very intimidating prospect. So. Would you have anything to say about that?
Well, I don't know if this would work for everyone, but I'll just describe the process that I went through. And this might be a sort of a reflection of my personality and how I do things generally. But what I did first of all was I came up with the broad structure, and then I, within that broad plot line, if you like, I sort of broke it into sections and added more and more detail. It's sort of like if you're building a cathedral, you have to get the frame of it before you start, worrying about the ornamentation. You need to start with the big things and then get progressively more granular. So I did that, and two things that I did that I think worked really well were, firstly, that idea of just get words on the page. People can really get caught up in this notion of this sentence that I'm writing right now has to be perfect. And so, for instance, I mentioned another friend of mine who was writing a book, and I don't think he ever finished it. I've lost contact with him now. But several years after I visited him, I said, "How's your book going?" And he said, "Oh, it's coming along." And I said, "But how much do you write each day?" And he said, "Oh, about two paragraphs." And I said, "Dude, you're never going to finish it." Because he said, "I know, but I'll just deliberate over one paragraph for an hour." So I don't think that's the way to do it. I think you get the product on the page or whatever you're doing. You get a lump of clay or whatever. And it's a process of refining, refining, refining. But you get the thing there first. And that has a psychological effect too, that you think you feel a sense of accomplishment. You don't feel like you're going to be overwhelmed by this thing. So, as I said, every day I made sure I wrote a certain amount. The other thing that I did at the end of each day was, because I had this sort of broad plan of where things were going, I would spend maybe 15 minutes at the end of the day going into what I would do the following day, so that I could then hit the ground running the following day. And there was a continuity there too. So it's sort of about these little strategies, if you like, to make sure that you never get writer's block or this kind of concept. It's incremental progress and setting yourself up to avoid failure, to always be taking a step forwards, even if it's only a small step, but to always be taking a step forwards and to know where you're going, broadly speaking. And it really is, a lot of it is just sort of, I wouldn't say it's tedious, but it's just, you plod through it, because the idea that, well, I've got to get this whole symphony on a piece of paper within the next 2 hours, that's the wrong way to approach it, because you will feel overwhelmed and you will never know how to begin it. You start with a small thing. Ideally, you plan as much as you can, but you start with a small thing and you build from there.
I think just to counter signal you, one danger with doing that, using that approach, is you might sort of get something done quickly, just going to dump 500 words onto the page, but then you're stuck with the problem where you've got a huge monster, and how you've got the huge job of trying to tame it and refine it, and redraft it, and then maybe, oh God, I can't even be bothered because it's going to be such a complicated task. I think there's a place for inspiration. I think rather than a sort of middle point between these two strategies would be just write bits, so that then you've got something to work with. You've got the clay to work with, but there isn't the stifling structure that you might want to redraft, because that would be a lot of work. But if you've got bits, if you've got glimpses of this and that, then it's something to work with and it's not stifling. That's what I would say here. Because I remember with my one, I wrote that this is what I did. This is what worked for me. Whenever an idea occurred to me, I wrote it down. That's one thing. Write down idea you have. Have a single file where you record every idea that you have. Don't have them scattered across, for God's sake. Just have them all in one place. Don't think that you'll remember everything, because you will not. You will forget ideas, even if they're really good ones. And what I did was I would write glimpses like that. That thing, that character in that situation, even if it was a character I didn't know yet, I would write something. And that's how I did it. I mean, there's a lot that I could say, but this is your stream, so I don't want to hog the limelight. So
I mean, this might be a personality thing, because I basically wrote it from start to finish, in order. And yeah, that's probably how I like to do things. But the way I did it, as I said, is that I started with the broad arc of the story, and then I just got progressively more focused on smaller sections. So that when I would come to write a chapter, I would know the arc of that chapter, and I would have whatever, let's say 6 points or 10 points or whatever within that arc. So I'd start with the arc, then I'd break it down to however many points. And then I had a structure such that I could just write. And there was a certain amount of momentary inspiration. I didn't know the exact form it was going to take. I knew that it was going to get to this particular point, and had a sort of a broad outline of the wayposts on that path. I didn't have every single detail laid out before I came to write it, but I had a structure such that I was able to get to where I wanted to go. And there'd be, you know, interesting little diversions along the way, but ultimately I would stay on track. That's all I'm saying in regard to that. Yeah. So, and that will vary, of course. Some people like to be extremely logical and detailed and plan everything out. Some of them like more freedom, creative freedom. And that's going to be an individual thing, depending on people's personalities and their own creative processes. But I think having some sort of structure and some sort of idea of, okay, this is what I want to accomplish today. This is by the end, you know, in 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever, this is what I want to have done. And this is where I want this thing to go and finish for today.
Yeah.
Because that way, you know, you don't think, it doesn't become this insurmountable problem for you. You know, how am I ever going to finish this thing? I don't even know where to start, and so on. So that's the way I approached it, basically. And
one other thing that I don't think I definitely had times like that as well, where it would be, I have to write that chapter, and here's a list of things that I've written down that need to happen in that chapter, need to be mentioned in that chapter, need to be established in it, whatever it is. The other thing is a single file of a to-do list, like problems with, like, does that character have the right motivation? Is that, is this thing explained or conveyed sufficiently? What about this ambiguity? When was this thing stated? Has it been sufficiently asserted? And that kind of stuff is a single file that is a to-do list of things that need to be done with it, with the whole novel. And again, a single file. Don't have it scattered across God knows where, because things will get lost.
Yeah, and I think having that plan of attack actually frees you up to make creative decisions and to add in interesting little bits as you go along. That's what I found anyway. There were a couple of chapters that were quite... There's one in particular in the book that's sort of a dream sequence, and that was a... I don't even know where that came from. It was sort of a stream of consciousness in many, many regards. It frees up those moments, I think. Whereas if it's just this insurmountable project, then almost counterintuitively, you're going to become overwhelmed by that, and your creativity will be stifled as a result.
Oh, definitely. I've been like that, not in the realm of novel writing or creative writing, but in the realm of programming, where I've been writing a program and it becomes so big and monolithic and unwieldy that it's just a nightmare. I think with novel writing or creative writing, it's, you do have to look at it almost like you're performing an operation, like a medical operation, or where there are so many things to consider that you can't leave it to memory. You've got to actually think of it quite, you know, the actual act of writing might be quite sensual. It might be quite improvised and all that when you're actually writing. But you've also got to have this very surgical head on your shoulders, where you're thinking very analytically about what is, are the various things performing as they should? That subplot, that character, is it all actually happening, or not? And as I say, that you've got to be both spontaneous and sensual, but also very analytical and quite ruthless.
Mm. Yeah, of course, of course. So, in terms of talking about the book itself and the
please move on. This has been a very interesting discussion so far, and I hope it's been of use to some people. I hope it's inspiring some people. But now let's hear about your work.
So, the book itself is a high fantasy novel, and again, part of the reason for that was that guy I mentioned, the other friend of mine who was writing, he was writing a fantasy novel. And I asked him why that, because he had studied literature at university and he'd done some sort of highbrow stuff and all of that kind of thing. And he said because of the structure of it, fantasy, science fiction also, in many ways you're free to say things that you couldn't or wouldn't necessarily say if you wrote a book set in a contemporary scenario, for instance. So that was part of that. Now the book, I think, basically has two sets of themes. One is a sort of a macro set of themes. So the basic plot is that there are the four protagonists ascend to another part of the world that is sort of more advanced, if you like, culturally and so on and so forth, to learn about these other cultures, because some of these cultures are starting to colonize their own lands. So they want to go and learn from these people so they know how to fight back, essentially. And along the way, they encounter a massive number of other cultures. And these cultures are in various states. So there's this sort of macro theme about the rise and fall of civilizations. It covers politics, economics, religion, culture, war, all of these sort of macro themes, and there are these different societies that are often contrasted with one another as a result. So there's that sort of thing going on, but at beneath that level, the story itself is actually, and I'll probably mispronounce this, but Bildungsroman, basically a coming of age story, because these four characters are quite naive when they leave their homeland, and there's this sort of hero's journey and all of this sort of stuff that happens along the way. But it also deals with a whole lot of other things like culture shock and homesickness and missing their families. So families are a recurring theme in this story. And another thing is that they develop friendships with people along the way in different places. And there are only a couple of female characters in the whole book. It's often about these sort of relationships between men, platonic relationships between men, and it's about sort of men interacting and all this camaraderie and all of this sort of stuff. So it deals with these sort of very personal themes of honor and regret and all of these sorts of things. So there are sort of two layers to it. One is all these sort of macro themes, and then running beneath that surface are all these micro themes. And this also, and the actual the plot line, the way these different characters develop, is also itself a comment upon the hero's journey and despair and all of these sorts of things, because different characters end up in different places eventually. And it's about that whole process of becoming worthy and this sort of thing. So, yeah, there's a lot going on there. I mean, it's 530,000 words, so it's long. It's really long. So there's a lot that I do cover in there. But it was... also an attempt to sort of get various things off my own chest, but also to, as I've mentioned several times, to inspire others and to get other people thinking about these things themselves.
So what would you say are the, I mean, if you had to list, say, 5 to 10 themes of this work, what would you say?
There are a lot. The main ones or the ones that I really like?
The ones you really like.
One is there's very much a theme of people going out into nature and sort of being only a small part of something much bigger to themselves, and they're out in the mountains, all this sort of stuff, and there's this sort of finding themselves in nature and just the vastness of things beyond themselves. that's the theme that I'm not sure if other people who have been following with the videos that I've recorded, if they've picked up upon that. But that's one of my favorite themes. Another is this sort of camaraderie between men and the development of those relationships. Another is two of the characters are full siblings, and there's this sort of relationship, and this they miss each other and this longing for each other and all of this sort of stuff. So those kinds of themes, I think they're a little bit more subtle. And then there's the whole sort of macro theme of the rise and decline of civilizations. And I did a massive amount of world building in this, even down to tiny little cultural rituals. So those who have been listening, there's one bit with the doors, the blue doors and the green doors in this particular culture. And just little details like that where I tried to make it feel lived in rather than just a vehicle for my own ideas. I tried to make it feel lived in so that people got a very different experience in each place, crafting the physical world as well. So those are the kinds of things that I really enjoyed. I think people possibly enjoy some of the sort of red-pilled ideas in there. And there are some humorous bits as well. I don't know if other people pick up on those. But, yeah, for me, it's the sort of the subtle things about people's relationships with each other and they're having to overcome things like homesickness or the death of friends and that sort of stuff.
To what extent did your own life experience play into this? People you've known and so on?
Oh, it did for sure. So there are some scenes that are directly lifted from real life experiences. There's one where there's a religious ritual where these guys are eating some snakes. And that was that whole scene was taken directly from an experience, not with eating snakes, but something similar to that, that I experienced when traveling. There were other things such as, the fact that when I wrote this, I lived abroad and I had traveled to a lot of different places and experienced culture shock and experienced homesickness and experienced sort of an alienation, but at the same time being an outsider and so being able to observe things from afar. So, yeah, there was a lot of that that was in there for sure.
That's interesting. I think with my novel, the setting, that the main character is in a particular setting throughout most of it, and it was definitely based on my experience of working a particular job when I was in my early 20s, and it happened just subconsciously. It's amazing how these things just sort of float up into something from that you've been through just suddenly becomes the thing that you're writing. It works its way into it somehow.
The thing that I really want you to publish your book in some form, partly because I think the version that I saw, I really liked it. I thought it was great. But also because it was kind of a proto woes, if you like. It was, you know, the proto millennial woes. And it's interesting to sort of see, the woes in embryonic form, in a sense, you know.
That's interesting because I see, that's why I'm nervous, or one of the reasons I'm nervous about finishing it, because it's now.
But let it stand as a snapshot in time. Don't edit it in such a way that you would impose current woes onto historical woes, if you like. Yeah. Because I think it's fascinating, and in some ways, it's almost like you were probably freer then, because there was no sense of expectation. You didn't have a massive audience. You didn't have any audience at the time. So it was, in some sense, it's almost a purer form of in some senses.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be a lot to say about this matter. I don't want to sort of detract from your own novel and your own story, so to speak. But yeah, it would be interesting. It's sometimes interesting to me to think, like sometimes I'll catch a clip from one of my early videos and I'll think, God, that's a long time ago. And then I'll think, holy shit, I'd already written a novel by the time I did that video. It's kind of very strange to think of it, you know?
I'm not even trying to sell my own book here, because I'm actually not trying to sell it. People have said to me, you know, you should publish it, self-publish it on Amazon or something. And I haven't tried to monetize it or anything. For me, it's just getting it out there. And I think you should just do that. I don't think you need to worry about that.
In terms of finishing it, the only real problem would be the motivation for the motivation for one of the characters, the female character, and the painting of that same character. It was a woman. I mean, male writers are notoriously bad at writing female characters, and I was the same. You know, I struggled with especially this female character. Whereas there is another female character in it who's very central, and she was easy to write because she was based directly on a woman that I knew in real life or had known several years before. So she was easy.
Just for my own reference, are you talking about the sort of older woman or the younger woman? Which one is which?
The one who was easy to write was the older woman, because she was my line manager at a job that I did. The younger woman was the one who was much more difficult to do. She was based partly on an online figure that I knew at the time, but I didn't know her. I mean, I barely knew her, so I was really trying to piece together a lot, and obviously I had to invent a lot. So it was, and I didn't really know many girls like her. So in real life, I hadn't met many girls like her. So it was difficult to fabricate her in my mind, but I was trying to do it anyway. And I think that might be, you know, if the novel has, I mean, it probably has quite a lot of flaws, but I think the main flaw is, and perhaps always will be, no matter what, how much work I put into it, that particular character. So it's something that annoys me, because there are other aspects of the novel that I'm really proud of, that I think it's a really nicely done thing here, you know, this aspect of it, that aspect, but I'm worried about that particular character.
Just a few things on that. Have you seen that Dan Curb has quoted Jack Nicholson's character from, I think it's As Good As It Gets. Do you know that line?
I'm seeing the comment, yeah.
Yeah, he's a writer in that movie. And he said, you know, Jack, you imagine Jack Nicholson's voice and his particular delivery. You know how I write female characters? I think of a man, then I remove reason and accountability. was that younger woman, she wouldn't have been based upon Laurie Penny by any chance, would she?
Oh, for God's sake, no, of course not. No, it was somebody much more British than her. No. It was a bloggeress that I encountered, right. And I was very taken with her, and I find her very interesting, and so I wrote this character. I mean, partly inspired, based on her. So there we are. But it's not something that I need to go into here, because it's kind of irrelevant to what we're talking
sure.
about.
So. Sure. But look, I would like to see you release this. As I said, I think so long as you didn't really revise it to make it sort of the modern version of yourself, I think it would be a very interesting snapshot of proto woes, if you like.
That's the thing. Even though it was actually quite a long time ago, I don't think I've actually changed that much. I mean, I've obviously become, you know, very well, because you and I knew each other from early 2012 onwards. You know that I have changed in terms of self-confidence, but I don't really think my ideas have changed very much. There we are.
It would be interesting. You know, I'd like to, well, maybe to come full circle, you having inspired me, I can now inspire you to get back on the horse.
yes, indeed. I think I'm on the way, I'm on the mend anyway. But in this respect, the novel, you see, the trouble is I would have to take a few months off from the channel in order to finish this big work. And I would not feel good about doing that just now, even like right now when I'm on the cusp of, I feel like I'm okay again with the channel. I feel like my nerves and my directionlessness and so on. So now wouldn't be the time, but hopefully sometime next year, it's something that I can do. As I say, it's 90% finished, 95% the novel. And then the tie-in novella is also about 3/4 finished. So I don't think I ever showed you that. It's an expansion of one of the chapters from the novel. And one of the chapters that I added in later on, 2013, which I was very, very proud of. And it's a very interesting idea. It's very, I think it is very original. About the brutalist town. I think I might have told you about it. So
I saw some maps or something that you made, building designs or something.
Yeah, I mapped out the whole town. Because I wanted to know what's happening. Because the main character is walking through this town, and meantime, I don't need to describe it. But so I wanted to have it all planned out, and so I looked for software that I could do this with, but none of the software did what I needed it to do. So I ended up actually writing the software with which to make this town plan. And so it was a big thing. It was a big piece of work just to add this subplot, and so that was later on, and that was towards middle of 2013, and then a few months later, I just had the idea to start a YouTube channel, And so the novel was just very... I thought it wouldn't last long. I thought the channel would just be a small thing, 20 videos. But it ended up being a huge thing. So there we are.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to really take up any more of Endeavor's time than necessary, because I realize I'm sort of eating into his time now. I've pretty much said all that I need to say on...
Okay. So people can hear the audio version of your novel on your channel, which is linked in the description box. Are there any other final things you'd like to say about everything that we've been talking about?
I'll just get to it, boys.
All right. Okay, well, let's leave it at that. It's been very good having the Franklin, Reactionary Expat, back on the channel. I'm very nostalgic about the old days when we used to... regularly in 2015 and 2016 have conversations, and we'd have them on Skype. It would be recorded and then they'd go up in the channel, and then also the month in reviews. But then they fell foul of the very problem that we've been talking about, too wrapped up in current affairs. But anyway, I don't want to go into that because I am
very super chats.
Oh, super chats. Let's see. Yeah. Hold on a second. Yeah. Okay. They are literally taking down paintings, books, and statues of white men. They even erased the cameo of Trump in Home Alone 2 in Canada. Did you hear about that? Broadcast, just for anyone else, CBC in Canada broadcast Home Alone 2. And there's one scene where Trump makes an appearance. Actually, Donald Trump appears just for one line of dialogue in this scene. And when they broadcast it the other day, they cut that scene out so that Trump wouldn't have his cameo. It's so pathetic. Anyway, they're literally taking down paintings, books, and statues of white men. How do we fight it? We even marched and they still took the statue down.
There's going to be more of that, yes. I think this is the kind of thing, it's like a parabola. And we're not at the bottom of the parabola, and we're not going to come out the other side just yet. But I think that if people are aware of it, and if they avoid patronizing all of this ugly nonsense, and of course, some of it will be state-funded and corporate-funded and so on, but if to some extent, if they vote with their feet and with their dollars, both in terms of boycotting certain things and supporting others, that will go some way to overcoming this and stay the course, I suppose. There's a lot of this stuff in private art collections and so on as well. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of film, I mean, they're not going to be able to erase that, because I'm sure millions of people have the original copy with Trump in it. So I'm not so concerned about that kind of thing.
Right. The other question comes from the same guy and is in the same vein. Many articles on Amren about how names of streets, hospitals and parks are being changed from white men to black women quite often. We are not doing anything about it, sadly. But this is the whole point. What are we this is what I said earlier. What are we going to do about it? What do you propose that we do about it if we don't have a cultural groundwork? If we don't have the cultural underbit upon which to do something about it? Right, you're saying let's just do something. What and how and what traction will it get if we're just a bunch of activists isolated and with no way to reach to persuade the mainstream? I really think you've got to think about this as a longer term thing, and don't be baffled or puzzled that nothing is happening right now. Nothing tangible is happening right now. Of course, it's not going to happen right now. I'm sorry to say that. Because I know it's depressing, and I certainly don't want to be defeatist. On the contrary, I'm trying to be realistic about this.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple of things. People need to teach other people about these things. And the other thing is, there's a lot to be said for old books, keeping those things around. I mean, how have various cultures around the world survived? How have they sort of re-emerged? By keeping these things alive, their storytelling, their old books, their folk songs, all of this kind of stuff. Some of these things can be surprisingly hard to beat down by the authorities. That's one of, you know, it's often as simple as singing a nursery rhyme to your child. That's how a culture is kept alive. You read a story to your child. Go and get secondhand books. I mean, they're throwing them away virtually. You can pick them up from charity shops here for next to nothing. And I'm steadily building a collection of things for my children in that regard.
Okay. Excellent. I think that's lots of good advice. Again, I don't want to be defeatist or black-pilled. I'm not. I just think let's be intelligent about this and understand there are a lot of things that need to be in place before we can expect to just get our way. On the contrary, until that point, we can expect to not get our way. And that's something that we're going to have to accept and not be assaulted by, not be hurt by when it happens, because it is awful. I mean, when you see a church being demolished, when you see another anti-white narrative in a film, it's enraging, it's infuriating. But for now, it's going to happen because there isn't something else, something better for white people to attach themselves to, but a sordid, genocidal mainstream culture.
And culture, there is an overarching aspect to it, but there's also a granular, local, personal level to culture that begins with people interacting one-on-one, having conversations, singing songs together, telling stories, whatever it is, at a very small local level. And if you can't expect to save culture if you're not doing that. Those are the building blocks, those are the foundations for the culture as a whole. So if you're not doing those little things on a daily basis, the culture itself won't save itself.
Yes, indeed. So ultimately it comes back to us. And yeah, okay. Well, let's leave it at that. Okay. Franklin, expat to me and to many people in the live chat who still remember your old name. This was a great stream. I really enjoyed it. I hope it's useful to a lot of people. I think it is. Yeah. Okay, I'll be back soon with Endeavor, but in the meantime, this was the Franklin. So thank you for taking part in Millennial 2019.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, excellent. I'll see you all very soon.